All right, we're ready for Luke chapter 22 in our study this morning. This is our outline we are following from Baxter, and we are in the final and last section of the book, dealing with the final tragedy and triumph as he words it. And so we are in Luke 22, 24 chapters here, so we only have two chapters to go. We're not going to review every chapter in the interest of time. We have 71 verses to try to cover, so we've got some ground to plow through before we get through. But we are going to look at some of these chapters. Chapter 4, what's it about? All right, that's where he began his Galilean ministry. Remember that? Galilean ministry. That's where that began. Chapter 5. All right. And chapter 6 is the Sermon on the Mount. Let's come down here to chapter 10. Yeah, here's the spread of that gospel message of Jesus. Let's go to chapter 15. Value of the lost, it demonstrated in three parables. Chapter 17, forgiveness and faith. Chapter 21 rather, last week, destruction of Jerusalem. That took place on what day of the Passion Week? Tuesday of Passion Week. All right, here we are. If you are so disposed to flag things in the margin of your Bible, we had just talked about that conflict with the Jews, that last public discourse on Tuesday, and either there is no record or I want to think that the end of chapter 21 suggests there was continual teaching, and we talked about all the ins and outs of that last time. If you were not here, you can go back and pick that up on the video. Anyway, Luke 21:38 maybe is the only reference about that, if there is one at all. So now we're ready to shift gears on the days. So in Luke chapter 22, beginning about verse 7, if you're ready to flag some of that and mark that in pencil, I say in pencil because you may change your mind about that and want to change that. Put Thursday here. We're ready for Thursday. This is the, on Thursday is the observance of the Passover. And his farewell to the disciples and the Garden of Gethsemane all takes place on Thursday. He entered Jerusalem on Sunday, cleansed the temple on Monday, the scathing rebuke conflict with the Jews on Tuesday, more teaching on Wednesday, or at least no record, to say the least. And then we're ready now to talk about Friday. So let's jump ahead, and we'll try to flag this as we get to it. But let's jump on over in Luke chapter 22. And talk about Friday, beginning about verse 54. And this is his arrest. This would have been in the early hours of the morning. His arrest, his trial, and his crucifixion will still be on Friday when we get into the next chapter, chapter 23. Make sense? All right. So we're dealing with Thursday and Friday in our studies today. We'll come back and say more about that here in a moment. So I've already mentioned we have some ground to cover. We have a lot of material to cover. And I want to try to deal with some of the things that where we may give a little insight that's not seen on the surface. And by that I simply mean we're not going to make a lot of observation about some of the very obvious things, but we'll try to talk about some of the others. Anyway, be that as it may, there are a number of things happen here. The main thrust of chapter 22 is Jesus is betrayed and he's arrested and the trial starts. There are six hearings we'll talk about. We'll have three of those run through quickly. Half of the trial will be over when we get through with the chapter. And so if you've read ahead and you say, well, I didn't see much of a trial, kind of a sham of a trial, well, that's the way it all went. Now, let's start with verse 1 here and get a little something about the timing here. This is a calendar that you are familiar with. You've seen it many times. Verse 1 starts at the Feast of the Unleavened Bread as it drew near, which is called Passover. Later in the text, we'll talk about eating the Passover. And so what are we talking about? Well, the Jewish calendar, our calendar is on the outside, starting with January right up here at the top in February, March, April. All right here at April is, at the end of March and the first part of April is the month of Nisan. And that's, it was in the middle of that month, on the 14th day of the month, is when the Passover took place, followed by seven more days of the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. So sometimes the term Passover referred to the Passover lamb that was killed. Sometimes it referred to merely the meal that was eaten, and sometimes the entire feast and festival. Does that make sense? So I take it that at verse 1, he's using it in that comprehensive sense. The time has come for the Passover. That is, both the Passover itself and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. Does that make sense? That's where we are. That's the timing of that. So this would be about 30 AD. So let's start with verses 1 and 2. 1 through 6, here's the Jews make a plot to kill Jesus. Why haven't they already done this? According to verse 2. The fear of the people. In other words, the crowds are still there. Later when Judas betrays him, he's going to betray him away from the crowds, the multitude. Some have suggested and talked at length about the political picture that's painted at verse 2. That they don't want to stir the people. They recognize that if we stir the people, we're going to have the agitation of the people against us. There's still crowds following him. There's still a multitude following him. Consequently, we don't want to stir the crowds. We want to do what we want to do, but we want to do it in a different way. Now, beginning at verse 3 through 6, Judas agrees to betray him. Let's talk about some of the things that are mentioned here that's not always mentioned in the other accounts. But that I mean, verse 3 says, Satan entered Judas, surnamed Iscariot. He was numbered among the 12. Now, we'll get to the rest of that in a moment. Let's talk about Judas, Satan entering his heart. What does that mean? The influence of Satan? At this juncture, let's look at a parallel account. John 13 gives us more insight than is found here. And by that we simply mean that verse 2 says that Satan had already put in his heart to betray Jesus. Now what does that suggest? Well, I don't think that suggests that Satan arbitrarily puts in his heart, he has no control, he has no influence at all himself, and so he's just, I can't help it, the devil made me do it kind of concept. That's not the idea. Let's go later. And John 13, look at over at verse 27. When Jesus is discussing who would betray him, he made the statement, the one to whom I give the piece of bread, when I have dipped it, and he dipped the bread and he gave it to Judas. Now, after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. But verse 2 said that had already happened. So that gives me some insight. What insight does that give me? It tells me that Satan entered him in the sense of the influence of Satan, the temptation of Satan, but it also entered him in that Judas allowed the decision of that influence to seep into his heart. Does that make sense? Same way Satan enters your heart. Satan is tempting, he's putting out the information, and so he's reaching out, tempting you, and so he's entered your heart in that sense. But when you allow yourself to follow the temptation, then Satan enters your heart in two senses. John 13 is your commentary on that. So in other words, the devil gained control of his life. He sought to seek control with his temptation, and then Judas then yielded to that. That's all it's really saying. Now what do we learn in verses 4, 5, and 6? Absolutely. Absolutely. He was the man who carried the bag of money, and he had been taking out of that. He'd been dishonest. He'd been stealing. So that shows he was not a true disciple. He was not a faithful disciple. He had greed. He had a love for money. Matthew 26 and 15 mentions the fact that he asks for money. Now, verse 5 said they agreed to give him money. And if this is the only record we have, we might get the impression that they said, would you betray him and we'll offer you money. But that's not the way it happened. Matthew tells us he asked for money. If you will give me money, if you will pay me 30 pieces of silver is what it was, worthless amount, I'll betray him. I'll give him to you. And they agreed to that. And notice at verse 6, then he promised and sought opportunity to betray. What do you learn from that? Absolutely. He's looking for opportunity. I see that Judas was more diligent and more faithful in doing wrong than he was in doing right. He wasn't seeking opportunity to serve the Lord. He was seeking opportunity to betray the Lord. Sometimes we're that way. We work harder at looking for opportunities to do what we want to do is wrong than we are in seeking opportunity to do what indeed is right. I'm sorry? Yes, it was intentional. All right, let's move on. That was the plot, Jews' plot with Jesus. Now, beginning at verse 7, Jesus and the disciples observed the Passover. So let's flag two or three things in this context that may be of interest to us. The day of the unleavened bread, the beginning of the unleavened bread, I believe Matthew and Mark both mentions, when the Passover must be killed. So that is the first of those 8 days that's being discussed. He sent Peter and John, and what did he tell them to do? Matthew mentions this, Mark mentions this, but Luke is going to focus on something that Matthew and Mark do not mention. All right. I want you to notice this now, what Ricky just mentioned. He tells them to go prepare the place so that we may eat the Passover because the day we're ready to do that. Now, where do you want us to prepare it? Well, go into the city, and there you'll find a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Some think that Jesus had made a prearrangement with this man. Maybe. I don't know. Text doesn't tell us. I think it's more divine knowledge that there would be a man carrying that. But here's another interesting aspect of that. Generally, carrying the pitcher of water was done by the women. Here's another sign that you're going to see something unusual. You'll see a man carrying a pitcher of water. You follow him. When you go back to the house, you're going to ask the master of the house, and you're going to tell him what we want, and he's going to carry you upstairs to an upper room. What are you going to find in the upper room? Furnished. And there we'll observe the Passover. So here's several things. And then notice it. We had a sermon about this based on Mark's account. Verse 13 said, when they went, they found it just like he said to them. There was a man carrying a pitcher of water, and he went back to a house. That house happened to have an upper room. It happened to have an upper room that was furnished. And the master was willing to let it be used. So found it just like the Lord had said. All right, with that in mind, let's go to instituting the Lord's Supper now. Let's go back to verse 15. He sat down with the disciples, and what do we learn from verse 15? He tells them something. Here we are, sitting down, ready to eat the Passover, and I have been... Yeah, I've been desiring, I've been wanting to eat this with you with fervent desire. Not just like it's okay to do that, but with fervent desire I want to eat with you before. You think they understood that? I don't think so. I don't think they have a clue what to suffer means. But before I suffer, I wanted to eat this Passover with you. Now then, beginning at verse 16, we have several things we want to flag here on the institution of the Lord's Supper. This ought to be familiar ground, but there are some questions that we need to clear up. Verse 17, or we're starting verse 16. I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled. Where? Kingdom. I think we had a question on this. I forget about my questions. Question number 3. From verse 18, though we haven't got there yet, it teaches the Lord's Supper to be partaken by certain ones. Who is that? Those in the kingdom. I will partake of it with you in the kingdom. Notice that at verse 16. So I will no longer eat of it till you partake of it in the kingdom. Let's drop down and we'll skip verse 17, come back to that. That I will drink of the fruit of the vine, not drink of the fruit of the vine, until the kingdom of God comes. There are some things we learn from that. What is that? What are some of the things we learn? One, the kingdom has come, and if it hasn't come, we have no right to eat the Lord's Supper. There are a number of people, in fact, most of the religious world believes the kingdom has not yet been established. We talked about that last Sunday. In the Louisville, Kentucky area where I used to live, there were a number of churches of Christ. If you know your history of churches of Christ, there was some controversy over premillennialism back in the 30s. That came out of Louisville, Kentucky. And as you drive around town, there'll be a Church of Christ here, Church of Christ there. Some of them are institutional. Most of them are non-institutional. But there'll be one here and one there and one over there that is premillennial. They believe the kingdom is yet to come, yet to be established. R.H. Bowl, those guys that followed him. Anyway, if the kingdom has not been established, then we have no right to partake of the Lord's Supper, do we? No Bible authority for that. All right. I want us to flag something else. And then I want us to get the flow of this section. Then at verse 17, we'll come back to the institution of the Lord's Supper, but some of those who argue that there is just one cup that we can use, that is one container, there are a few of those that think the cup is the fruit of the vine. And there's one, that the cup is the container, rather. They think the cup is the container and there can only be one container because the Bible just mentions one cup. Well, let's see what the cup is. Does the cup refer to the container or does it refer to the contents of the container? Let's see. Look at verse 17. Might mark this. He took the cup and he gave thanks and he said, take this. What had he just taken? The cup. This refers to the cup and divide it among yourselves. Take the container and divide it among yourselves. That doesn't make any sense, does it? Take the contents and divide it among yourselves. The cup refers to the contents. Now you know that, but here is a passage that you might make a marginal note, circle some things, underline that you can instead of scratching your head. I'm not sure how I can show that. Now you know. All right. Now let's flag something else at verse 20. You might go down and find it. Verse 20. He took the cup after supper. More recently, in some of this house church movement and the concepts of combining, there's some churches of Christ, so-called, or they don't use that term anymore, some of them don't, have combined a common meal with the Lord's Supper. And they think that's what the Lord did. The Lord had a common meal, the feast of the Passover, and used those elements, and part of that meal was the Lord's Supper. So we do that just like the Lord did. But I want you to notice this institution of the Lord's Supper was not part of the supper, but it was after the supper or the Passover meal. Might underline that in your text. All right. What do I learn from verse 19? He took the bread and said, what? Symbolizes his body, and do this in remembrance of me. And then the cup, what does he say about it?
Poured out for me, poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood.
Yeah, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, and which is shed for you. Now let's raise a question. You may remember this from our hermeneutics class. How many times did Jesus bless the cup? It would appear that he did it twice, because the text says at verse 7, he took the cup and he gave thanks. Verse 19, took the bread, gave thanks. Verse 20, took the cup after supper, saying, and he seems to have blessed it twice. That's not really the point here. Verses 15 to 18 focus not on not eating and drinking again until the kingdom was established. So notice this. No longer eat till the king, until the kingdom, verse 16. Verse 17, no longer eat and drink till the kingdom, verse 17. Verse 18, verse 17 is telling the time when he said that. When did Jesus make this statement, I'll not eat of it again until the kingdom is established? Well, verse 17 said it's when he took the cup and told them to divide it. That's the timing. Does that make sense? That's what he's focusing on. Now, the next section, by the way, that's not presented as true chronology, and I'll give you evidence of that in a second. Verses 19 and 20 focus on the establishment of the Lord's Supper. And in Matthew and in Mark, he took the bread and then the cup. He took the bread and then the cup. Does that make sense? I think that answers that. Luke was not intended to be a chronology. He took the bread, and he took the cup, then he took the bread, and then he took the cup. If so, if that's the true chronology, we need to partake of the cup, then the bread, and then come back and take the cup again. That don't make sense, does it? What he's doing in 15 to 18, he's focusing on when he'll partake of the Lord's Supper. It's when the kingdom would be established. When did he say that? Verse 17 is the timing of that. Verses 19 and 20 is the establishment of the Lord's Supper. He took the bread and then he took the cup. That's the same order in which we find in Matthew 26 and also in Mark 14. Does that make sense? Now, more could be said about that, but we're going to move on in interest of time. Now, what happens in 21 to 23? Yeah, someone's going to betray me. And the betrayer is with me at the table, and they begin to want to know who it was. Luke doesn't record the question. What was the question they asked? Is it I? Is it I? Now, notice in John 13 again, and we're going to flag John 13 a couple of times. At this same meal, Jesus hands the bread to Judas and tells him, "What you do, do quickly." Did the disciples understand that? No, they didn't understand that. Here's how I know. No one at the table knew for what reason he'd said that to him. I'm reading in John 13 and in verse 28. Some thought, because he had the money bag, that to go buy those things needed for the feast or give something to the poor. And they thought, well, he's giving him some instructions about spending money and he's sending him off to do that. They didn't understand what he's talking about. But Jesus said to him, do what you're going to do and do it quickly. And so he identified Judas as indeed being the one. All right, let's move on. Still did it, yes. And then takes the money back and then later hangs himself. It's all worthless and he accomplishes nothing by doing that. All right, let's start with verse 24 now through verse 30. The disciples argue over greatness. Here Jesus at the supper is talking about suffering and one's going to betray me. And how discouraging it must have been to look around and the disciples are more interested in something else. They can't keep focused. What are they arguing about? Who is the greatest? In other words, again, a materialistic kingdom, who's going to hold the chief position? Who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom? So how does Jesus answer that? He said, you're like the Gentile. Now this has got a sting to a Jew. This is the way the Gentiles behave. The Gentiles have lordship over them, and those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. A couple of translations, New Century, New Living, says friends of the people. Caldwell argues in his work that it gives a number of examples where some leaders, some kings, would have a title that meant, I am a benefactor. In other words, you were to address them as the benefactor. You are the one that takes care of us. You are the one that benefits us. And so here's the one in authority. Here's the one in position. I want you to know that I take care of you and I'm greater than you, is what they're saying. Jesus said, but not so among you. Who is the one who's greater? He gives two illustrations. The one greater in the kingdom is the one who is like the younger. I don't remember Matthew mentioning that, nor Mark. The younger usually should give preference and defer to those who are older and wiser. But you're going to be the greatest is the one who's like the younger, who defers to others. That's the greatest, not the one who says, you defer to me. I'm the greatest. That's not the greatest. It's the one who is like the younger who defers to others. Does that make sense? And then the second illustration he gives, the one who serves, not the one who governs. That's the one who serves. Now, there's a couple of interesting thoughts at verse 27, 28, 29. For who is greater, the one that sits at the table or one who serves? What's his question? Generally, it would be the greater one would be the one sitting at the table, not the servant. Here's the king sitting and his servants running around. Who is the greater? Well, it's the king sitting at the table. But he said, Yet I am among you as one who serves. At this very setting, what Jesus has just done, John 13, say again. Wash their feet as an humble servant. He's trying to demonstrate to them, here's humble service. You want to talk about who's the greatest? Y'all are worried about who's the greatest, and yet I'm with you and I'm serving you. What else do you see? 28, 29, and 30. Verse 28 seems to be a commendation of the disciples in spite of their lack of understanding, in spite of their failures, etc. He commends them for sticking with him through his trials. And yet he said, I bestow upon you a kingdom just as my Father has bestowed upon me. That's interesting. I don't remember Matthew mentioning that. And you may that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. There's a lot in that. Let's unpack a little of that if we can. I think he's saying, I'm going to give you a role in the kingdom just as the Father has given the kingdom to me. When he ascended to the Ancient of Days, Daniel 7, probably is alluded to, at least in principle. That's the best I can do with verse 27. It's a role in the kingdom. And they would sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. In what sense? We're not told. Some think it has reference to ultimately in the judgment in the end of time. I think it more likely has reference to their work and the revelation and the teaching and the preaching of the word. But you choose which of that or maybe another one that you think. But the point is that y'all are talking about who is the greatest. You will have a role of influence in the kingdom, but you need to understand this principle of service. Make sense? Questions? Comments? All right, 31 to 34. We still got some ground to go. This is the Lord warning Peter that he will deny him. He said, Peter, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked for you. You may be aware of this, but if not, this may be a good time to flag that word you is plural. Meaning Satan has asked for all of you, all of my disciples. That he may sift you as wheat. Robertson says that's a winnowing fan. Bedag says it's a shaking. That Satan wants to shake you, sift you, as a winnowing fan, it's an idea of separation. He wants to find out what you're made of and see if he can get you. He's after you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you. Take that word, you. That's singular. Now, how would it make you feel if the Lord said, Satan wants this whole church, but I've prayed for you and called you by name? Well, why me? Because you are going to falter. What do you pray for him or pray about? That his faith wouldn't fail. But he said, when you return, suggesting that his faith would fail, strengthen your brethren. A lot of practical things in that. When he comes back, he could be of help. He could be of strength. But even though the Lord prayed for him, the bottom is going to fall out of his faith. And Peter responded in his overconfidence, and what did he say? That will never happen to me. And yet it did. He said, before the rooster crows this day, you'll deny me three times. All right, let's move to the disciples are told to prepare with a wallet and a bag and a sword. He alludes to Matthew 10 and said, when I sent you out before, I'm paraphrasing, I sent you out without a wallet, without provisions, etc. And did you lack anything? And they said nothing. In other words, I took care of you. I'm going to take care of you again. But this time I'm sending you forth. And if you don't have a money bag, or if your man has a money bag, let him take it. And likewise a sack. And if you have no sword, sell your garment and buy one. That's interesting. Luke is the only one who mentions this. Get the sword and take it with you because of the dangers. And some think, well, that's not a literal sword. Well, the disciples said, we have two swords. Must be a literal sword. And then later there's a sword mentioned. Literal sword. Take a sword with you. There's going to be dangers along the way. Self-protection. Take that sword with you. And then he said that it must be accomplished what's written. What was written of him in Isaiah 53? He would be numbered with the transgressors, Isaiah 53, 12, for the things concerning me have an end. In other words, here is a prophecy concerning me and it's going to come to pass. And the disciples, this is interesting to me, said, we've got two swords. They can't keep focused. Jesus had told them, take a sword with you, and da, 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 da. And then he said, because the things concerning me are going to have to be fulfilled, and in other words, I'm going to be sacrificed, I'm coming to death. And the disciples still focused on the sword. We've got two swords. And they're not focusing at all on what he's saying about his death. All right, let's go to the Garden of Gethsemane. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays in the garden beginning at verse 39. He went to the Mount of Olives as he was accustomed, the text says. The disciples followed him. Verse 40, he said, pray that you not enter into temptation. Matthew's account, Mark's account, Matthew 26, 38, Mark 14, 34, he told them to watch. Now harmonizing those, the way I watch is praying that I not into temptation. Does that make sense? Now Matthew adds, because the spirit is and the flesh is weak. Luke only mentions two times that Jesus prayed, that if it be possible this cup pass, nevertheless not as I will, but as you will. But he prayed three times. Now, let's go to verse 43. An angel appeared to him, strengthening him. How did he do that? We're not told. It may be by his presence, some have suggested. Others have suggested it was something the angel said. Others suggest he gave him physical strength. Others suggest that maybe it was through praise, praising him as the Messiah, some comforting action. How did he strengthen him? We're not told. But an angel came in the Garden of Gethsemane and strengthened him. Now, let's see, verse 45. Why were the disciples sleeping? We have a question about that. Luke is the only one who mentions this. Question number 8. For sorrow. They're sorrowful, but they don't even understand everything that's going on. All right, let's start at verse 47 now. Here we have his arrest and betrayal. I know we're kind of moving on rather hurriedly. And I want to get to the trial so that we can say something about the trial. At verse 50, first of all, Judas comes out and kisses him and betrays him. And verse 50, one of them took a sword and cut off the high priest's right ear. Who was that? Did that? This text doesn't tell us. That was Peter, John 18, 10. Malchus was the servant whose ear was cut off. What did Jesus do with the ear? That was ignored. Isn't that interesting? We want to kill this Jesus, but he just worked a miracle, but we're still going to kill him. We ignore the miracle. We ignore the evidence. Now let's begin at verse 54. We're ready for Friday now, and I know we're hurried, but I want to get to this. Peter denying the Lord beginning at verse 54. Verse 54, and I just wanted to flag this out. Annas, the former high priest, and Caiaphas, their headquarters are thought to be in the upper city. There was the lower city, the upper city, the temple compound. So this is a map of Jerusalem. It's thought in this region of the upper city, what was thought to be the upper city, or called the upper city, is where that compound would have been, where Annas, the former high priest. So let's flag some things here. I'll come back to that if possible, but here's what we have. There were two trials. We're going to mention this time and again, the Jewish trial and the Roman trial. Each trial had three hearings each. This started in the late night of Friday, and by Friday at 9 o'clock, he's on the cross. So in less than about 12 hours, they've gone through this whole trial. Six hearings in less than 12 hours. Does that make sense? Shows you what a sham of a trial. Now, not every one of these are mentioned by Luke. Luke mentions 5. You say, I only see 4. That's because I didn't flag the other one. He mentions Annas. We're going to flag that here. And he mentions these other four, and he doesn't mention Pilate again. So let's see what we have. You might flag Annas at verse 54. They brought him to the high priest. And it was at the house of the high priest, who thought to be Annas and Caiaphas both, but they take him first to Annas. How do I know? John 18, 12 to 14 says they did that. Because he was the former high priest. He doesn't have any real authority. All right, and we're going to come back to that. So this is the hearing, probably mentioned at verse 24, and Peter denies that he knows anything going on. So we have the denials three times there. Now, they then rush him off. Now, these are approximate times, so around 12 to 1. Then by 2 to 4, Luke starts at verse 63, and he talks about going before Caiaphas, the current high priest, and the Sanhedrin. It was not legal for them to have a meeting before daylight, so they're going to have to meet again. So what we have is, I've harmonized Matthew, Mark, and Luke, so they bring false testimony. Caiaphas asked him if he's the Son of God. He said yes. Caiaphas said he's guilty of blasphemy. There's no need of other witness, and asked the crowd, what do you think? He's worthy of death. This is where Luke jumps in. They blindfolded him, spat on him, and beat him, and they struck him. That's about all that Luke mentions. Not much of a trial here, is it? Not much of a legal hearing. It's illegal because it's before daylight. Jews couldn't do that. So that's why they go before the Sanhedrin in the early hours of the morning, starting at verse 66. So you might flag that at verse 66, they're there before the Sanhedrin again. What happens in this hearing? They ask, are you the Christ? And he said, if I tell you, by no means believe. And if I ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter the Son of Man will sit at the right hand of the power of God. And then, are you the Son of God? And he said, you rightly said that I am. And they said, there's no need for further witness. You say, well, we hadn't spent much time on any of that. And that's about how much time was spent. What I want you to see is that's what we have in Luke 22. Now, we're going to get to the Roman trial. This is the Jewish trial. So they took him to Annas. Wasn't much done there. They rush him off then within a couple of hours. So from midnight to about 4 in the morning, they're already gone through their second hearing. And their accusations are basically worthless. They beat him. They spit on him. And now we got to have some legal formality. So let's take him before the Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court. And are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? He says, I am. We don't need any further witness. They can't execute him. The Romans have to do that. So now we're ready for a Roman trial. What a sham of a trial. That's what I want you to see. Does that make sense? Questions, comments? I know that was hurried. We had 71 verses. Our time's about gone. Or actually is gone. 72, I think. I think I'm right about that. I believe it's 72. Am I right, Drew? Is that right? I think that's right. Good question. 72. But whether they were all present, I don't know. Because it didn't matter about whether it was legal or not. It didn't matter. All right, we're going to stop right there. We'll pick up with the Roman trial next time in Luke 23.